So what do you want to talk about this week, Wolf?
Very exciting topic. Follow-up.
I don't know. Are you sure you can fill a whole 10 minutes with follow-up?
Oh, you know it's easy.
Alrighty, we'll have at it.
Okay, so first off, one thing I realized when I was going through kind of the backlog of tweets and emails is that, you know, we've had this format change. I don't think we ever kind of addressed it head-on type thing. And it's actually kind of funny because you've told me before that people apparently didn't even notice that we had a bit of a format change.
It really surprises me.
Yeah. So first, initial format is that you'd have the big intro, and we even used to have music, and then we'd even an odd with you being even, me being odd, the topics where I would that I would do an episode, and you do an episode, and we'd end up talking to the person afterwards, like follow up questions and stuff like that, but mostly. One of us owned an entire episode. And with this...
Yeah, you would think it would be pretty clear that we were alternating. I don't get it.
They're simple programmer folk. I don't think they,
Maybe.
So, and part of it is that we also used to have... the intro used to mention that, not a part of the intro, part of the outro was that you'd mentioned that, we have this, you give us feedback at whatever edgecasesshow@gmail.com or whatever our real address is, which I think that's our real address, isn't it?
No, it's feedback at edgecasesshow. Thanks. You've just, I check both email addresses, but as it, if you want to be sure you go to the correct one, then maybe we could cut that out and then have a very puzzling in our show.
I think people need to know the extent of my incompetence. So
so feedback at edgecasesshow.com.
It sounded wrong when I said it, so there we go. It ends up boiling down to a Gmail address, so that's why I...
Yes.
But anyway. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of mention that format change I'm kind of on the fence about it because I know that with the email, you kind of, when we started the show, I was actually, the format I had in mind was very much similar to what we have now, that I didn't want any introductions to us. I'd even want to even call out who we are, which I guess we don't anymore. And
it's the Gruber model.
Right. It's a couple people talking, right? Which I think actually works better if you have like a host that's the anchor and then you have a different voice each week. Then the non-anchor voice is the guest, and you can eventually puzzle it out. But with us, unless you listen to back episodes, it's very unclear who's who. But anyway, so we have this, the email address, and used to rattle it off, and we used to get a good amount of feedback. And I've always been of two minds of this, because on one hand, I just want to kind of get on with the show. I want to, kind of blast them out as we go. And I never want to look back, man. It's just like, I want to keep going. But I found that with this shortened amount of time we're putting in each section now. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons for the format change is that it used to be that we'd prep big time for each show. And that was basically...
Multiple hours.
Yeah. And that was awesome for 100 episodes. And it turns out we have lives. And so that's one of the reasons why for the 100th episode, it's like, okay, I've done this. I've said my piece. And we don't have to keep on, preparing for days to get any single episode out. And you sold me on the kind of this minimized model that we won't have to prepare nearly as much. And of course, part of it is also we don't do the big reveal where we actually know what each other's topic is going to be.
Yeah.
Which I think is fine so long as we basically lowered the amount of effort to put out an episode greatly so that we can keep putting them out. So, and considering that people don't even seem to notice, I think it's been a winning formula. But anyway, I will start with the most important thing, which is the corrections. And I would say that arguably neither of these are actually correction. But I think, that we'd never say anything that's actually incorrect. But
of course not.
I will say that at least it falls under the heading. I will put it under the corrections tag. On episode 101, a program that runs on metal, Doug Russell. I was going to say friend of the show, Doug Russell, and he's a friend of both of ours, but I realize that, I'm just going to go down through all these names, and I'm going to say a friend of the show on pretty much all these. And so I think a better strategy
We're friendly.
A better strategy is to call it enemies of the show. So we'll just assume friendship, or at least neutralness, but we'll call out enemies. So I don't know who that'd be yet, but maybe that we can, our listeners can suggest who the enemy of the show should be. But Doug...
is this good? Because then we're encouraging users to, listeners, to try to piss us off.
That's so. Yeah, I haven't really thought this through. Good point. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Doug Russell wrote in that I apparently bemoaned on episode 101 about how there was no way in Objective-C to require a subclass implement a method in a protocol, and where you have to provide a base implementation. So it turns out that circa 10.10, Objective-C actually supports this, and it is all in uppercase, ns_protocol_requires_explicit_implementation. And this is a macro that boils down to a Clang attribute, which is OBC protocol requires explicit implementation. But basically, it's a way of kind of marking this type of stuff. And so that's great. I had no idea existed. I Googled around for it, and it seems like it's not very well known at all. And apparently, it does exist in the Apple's header files for at least the accessibility framework. So you can check it out, see how it's used.
Well, wait, so I implement a class which implements a protocol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to, if it's not set up as optional, I have to implement everything that's listed as not optional for the category, excuse me, for the protocol. Does that mean a subclass of that class also needs to implement something different?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's what it is. Okay, so it's, yeah, all right, okay, yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. In episode 110, Scripting with C, Nikolaj Schmauher told, I had mentioned that in Playgrounds, or either you or me, you know, the cell wall between us gets dissolved and I don't know who's who, that we couldn't import application or framework code in Playgrounds, which we talked about, really seemed to limit their usefulness. And mm-hmm. apparently since Xcode 6.0 beta 5, you can do this.
Yeah, I've heard that too, that it's possible now.
Yeah, I haven't been playing with Playgrounds. I'm a very, you know, all work and no play makes Wolf a dull boy. But and he also has an interesting take on this, is that he wrote he has a project that I'll link to called Swift Hamcrest, which is Hamcrest Matchers, which is its own topic that we'll probably eventually get to one day. But you can check it out. And what's interesting is that he implements, he has a standard, you know, readme.md markdown file that kind of, you know, tells you how to use it. But he's actually kind of as a proponent of using the Playground as like live documentation. That his Playground is all set up, ready to go in the Xcode project, so you can fire it up and you can start tinkering with his code immediately. So
start trying it, yeah, then that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart use. In episode, okay, so that's done with the two quote-unquote corrections, which might not have been corrections at all, but well. In episode, going all the way back to episode 69, the Time Machine Worst Case Scenario, I got feedback from both Nicholas O'Reilly and Augie Fackler that they have been successfully using basically networking for doing Time Machine backups. And so Nicholas O'Reilly is using a Mac with file sharing turned on, and you can have that behave like a time capsule, so you don't actually need a time capsule itself or macOS 10 server. And Augie Fackler is using, he has a free BSD box that actually runs ZFS, and he's using Netatalk 3.x, I don't know what particular version, but apparently anything in the 3 or greater range can do this. Netatalk is an open source Apple Share implementation, Apple Share filing protocol. And so the cool thing about this is that Nicholas Riley chimed in about how he, you know, about once a year his file system gets corrupt, and he has to have backups, as I mentioned in the show. But with FreeBSD running ZFS, you're probably going to not have that issue. And apparently you can also explicitly state your amount of backup size. So it works pretty well, and I've actually been considering doing something, what Augie has been doing, running a FreeBSD server, running ZFS, and then using that as a Time Machine source, or I'm sorry, destination. And it's good to know it worked for him. In episode 108, Playing Jenga with Microsoft Word, I mentioned that was the episode that had a bunch of talk about like writing your own backends, and I gave a bunch of links. And Kyle Martin pointed out Helios.io, which I knew about, but It bills itself as an extensible open source mobile backend framework written by Matt Thompson. And I had known about it, and I don't think I even noticed like there was an introduction for it. I think I just like looked at Matt Thompson's like GitHub activity. I saw he was working on it. That's how I get all my news is via GitHub public activity feeds. And it offers data synchronization that it will generate a REST web service. Interestingly enough, can automatically generate it from a core data model. That seems optional, but seems very interesting. Push notifications, in-app purchases, passbook, newsstand, logging, and analytics. It kind of assumes Heroku, at least a generous Rails app. And that's one of the reasons why I knew about it. I didn't mention it because I haven't used it myself. And I know that Matt used to work at Heroku, and now works at Panic, I think. And I didn't know if he was if this project was even still alive because it's still built as beta. But I did look at Matt Thompson's public activity, and I saw that he just recently did a couple of check-ins on it. So I don't think the project's dead. So it's still in beta, has been in beta for a while, but it's something you should probably check out. In episode 110, Scripting with C, I mentioned my befuddlement about the KZ prefix in the classes. And it turns out that I read in the Hacker News article that he shouldn't use KZ, even though it's the name, the initials, that was par for course type stuff. So Michael Buckley gave me a couple tweets here. And so it turns out KZ is a German acronym for concentration camp. So KZ playground could point to a disturbing picture to German-speaking people. Similarly, NS is a German acronym for the Nazi Party. So finally, it took us, how many episodes? 115. But finally, EdCases has embraced Godwin's law that we've gone Nazi. And don't you pretend to speak German? Like, why did you not point this out to me?
Because NextStep has been around for like 20 years, and while that may be true, it doesn't seem to have been something that was a large scale issue for a lot of the Germans that I knew.
Okay.
So that's why, NS, like, I mean, I think this is actually a case where it might have been something that originally made developers think of that, but I would think that NS as the first initials of a class now has been kind of reclaimed back as being something that now, it definitely means Apple or NextStep rather than anything else. So it's interesting how that kind of thing goes, because I would say that, KZ probably hasn't been reclaimed in that fashion. But I would think that NS is.
I think you might just be a Hitler apologist.
Or an Apple apologist.
It really is the same thing. Oh, no.
Is there any difference?
Oh, God. We've gone full Godwin. There we go.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. And Sven S. Prost also pointed this out to us. So another friend of the show, which I will not call friends anymore. Not that he's not my friend. It's terrible. Anyway. And finally, for episode 114, The Pyramid Doom, a pretty recent, I guess, last episode, Drew McCormick chimed in that he says that he wrote a blog posting last year about trying to get around with the problem with the Pyramid of Doom. It's called The Lessons of Functional Programming for Cocoa Developers. And I'm glad he linked to it because I don't remember this article. I don't know how I missed it. I think it might have been in my dark period where like Google Reader had closed down, but I hadn't set up on the next thing or whatever, and a news blur. But it's a good read, and he also has a open source project that goes along with it called CDE Asynchronous Task Queue. It's part of Ensembles in general, but you can check it out. It's open source, and I'll link to that. And it reminded me that I actually look at Drew's way of dealing with this, is that I also shipped a project in 2011 that I called Blockstep, which also kind of brought, there's this a project called Step for Node that kind of like tries to defeat the Pyramid of Death. Pyramid of Doom by basically chaining functions. And so I basically pour that to Objective-C with blocks. Are you laughing at me?
Well, Pyramid of Death actually sounds quite a bit worse than Pyramid of Doom.
Yeah, but, that's true. They're Doom and Death. They seem fairly equivalent to my mind, but oh well. So I will also link to my Blockset project, which I looked at, and I apparently did a really bad job of documenting it. So maybe before the episode actually ships, I will go and update its readme.md to actually show you how to use it, because it didn't get very much traction when I shipped it. But I guess I wasn't going to ship it again
with comments?
At least I'll just give example of how to use it. Because right now, the only example that exists in it is in the test, unit tests for it. So and that's no good. That's no good. But yeah, so that boils down all the feedback that I could fit into. I was going to say 10 minutes, but here we are, 15 minutes. I guess we won't have to do another one of this until episode 230.
Right. Yeah. We're good. So appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so my topic this week is converting a small Objective-C project to Swift.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a theoretical topic. I've talked about how I worked on a hackathon project for WatchKit a couple weeks ago. That is at github.com/apontius/watchset. And I won't spell Apontius because I spelled Apontius for like 70 episodes, so you should know by now. The last two commits on it are my changes for it to converting it to Swift. Whereas previously it was Objective-C. Now, it was Objective-C because this was a hackathon, and again, I think I talked about it last week, I talked about this, maybe not, that you only have a certain amount of time, so since Swift is not something that I have shipped projects in yet,
mm-hmm.
I decided to go with what I knew already and do it in Objective-C. But also, these kind of little projects, which don't have that much to them, are really fairly prime examples of things that can be converted to Swift. Because you know you won't have to deal with the full weight of a giant set of libraries or anything like that to convert those. So it's a good test case. So I'm going to go through what I did on that and the kinds of things that I learned from it. This is going to be very light on theory. I think a lot of times when people talk about Swift, they're going very deeply into things like functional or type theory. Robricks. So I'm not going to be doing that, but I'm going to be just talking about practical stuff. So the first thing that I'll get to is the main file, which of course in an Objective-C project is main.m, and in Swift is a main.swift file. Now, Objective-C's main file is a lot like what you would get in C projects or C++ projects for what, like 20 years, 30 mm-hmm. years now? In that they're all basically about this main function that is the first thing that's called by the runtime for your application. And again, that's something that's really very ancient. It goes back to the days when there wasn't no UI applications. It was all command line based. And you can see in a UI-based application, in a Cocoa or Cocoa Touch application, the boilerplate that you get for that is just a main that calls some sort of application main function from the library. And so really you're just seeing this ancient glue code
mm-hmm.
that, you know, you really shouldn't need. So what does Swift do? Well, Swift basically takes that up. If you were to make a project from scratch for Swift for a UI thing in I believe probably Mac as well. I didn't actually try Mac, but in Cocoa Touch anyway, it's just gone. And so I really appreciate that. I think that's a good idea. Now, when I was doing my conversions, and I'll talk about what the targets are in a minute, but there are a bunch of targets, but I decided to go ahead and remake the project, not by changing all the files manually
mm-hmm.
in my old project, but by actually making a new project because there were so many boilerplate files going on. And so again, one of the things I learned by doing that is, hey, there's no main.m file for my Cocoa Touch project.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good to know that because otherwise I might have tried to convert it manually or whatever. But there was also an OS X command line app as part of my project because the command line app was something that I would run beforehand to generate a sample game file out of it. And for that, there is still a main.swift file that gets created because you're not just calling into some boilerplate function to kickstart the UI. You're actually doing all of your work in that main function.
Right.
What's interesting is for the Swift version of that, there's still main.swift, but there is no main function in that the entirety of that file, all of the top level lines of it are basically your function. The whole thing gets called. So it's a lot like a scripting application.
Yeah.
And less like an app, less like one of these legacy C applications. So that was interesting to find out. I had not read that anywhere. So that was something I just kind of learned by looking at the boilerplate that you get. And the other little thing that I got from that, and I'll have a lot of other more miscellaneous details later, is I used a lot of, I use everywhere for values that are what are magic numbers, basically. You take them out of being magic numbers by making const values, const variables for them, global variables. And what I've done in C, in my C-based languages since forever, is static const, you know, k foo or something equals whatever. And then, you know, k foo is my reference thing for that, so I'll know what it is whenever I use it. I didn't do a lot of research on this, but what seemed like to be the smartest and the fastest thing to do would just be to turn those into let statements in Swift. I don't know if that's the best idea, because I don't know what the best practices are for that yet. Certainly there's not the same idea of a static value as there is in C, something where you know there's only ever going to be one of them, and you know what's going to be specific to the file. And it's kind of, you know, I don't know if it's exactly a hack, but it feels like something that's different layers of language logic or runtime logic to do that in. Of course, you can just, it looks like you can just say private let in your Swift file, and it certainly compiled, whether it does anything or not, I don't know, but it seems like if you say private let, what you're saying is, well, then that's for that specific file, because that's private to that file, and if you know, public let would let it be available to everybody else. I haven't tried to play around with that. That's something that I have to do, but I do know that with my static const variables, I could just turn them into let, and then that just worked. So I did it. That's for my initial one. Initial conversion here. Now, of the targets that I was using for a WatchKit application, there was the initial iOS app target and the test target. And then when I said, okay, now make me a WatchKit app, it added three more targets. The WatchKit app target, the WatchKit extension target, and was there a test target as well? That might have been it. All right, it might have only been two. Or I might have deleted the test target if there was one. And then the next thing that I had created on my own was a shared framework target, because that way I could share a framework with shared logic between the iOS app and the WatchKit extension. I actually didn't wind up using that very much, but I did, hey, let's just put everything, every model class in the target framework.
Yeah.
Excuse me, in the framework target. And then when you make one of those, you also get a framework test target. So what am I up to? At least, what, like five, six targets there?
Yeah, yeah. That was in the latest Core Intuition. They were just talking about all the targets, and Jalkut is going off like, you know, oh, I know, I've got this Xcode stuff down cold. Yeah. Yeah, I hear it's pretty target heavy.
And then the last target was that OS X command line app. So what I did was, because there are a lot of boilerplate files that you get for all of these targets, again, it just made more sense to start with a new project from scratch. And so there are a bunch of boilerplate files that you get. So for the iOS app target, there's an app delegate class with its own files and a view controller class with its own files. Now, in the Objective-C version, it's appdelegate.h and .m and viewcontroller.h and .m. In Swift, of course, there's only appdelegate.swift and viewcontroller.swift. I don't believe I changed those at all, because I never actually did anything with the iOS app. And so it was actually quite nice to be able to just say, well, just swap these files directly, and you're done. You know, you got a Swift version, and you're done. And I believe it was the same thing with the test file as well, that since I didn't touch it at all, just let it go. Same thing with the WatchKit extension. So I had checked the checkbox for a notification support, which means you got a notification controller class. And again, didn't touch it. Threw in the Swift version of it. I was done. And I said I had two commits for Swift migration. The first commit was just all of these boilerplate files. So I just figured, you know, check all those in for the first round before I actually touch anything, before I make any code changes.
Yeah, I think that's smart, segregating those commits. And yeah,
right. But I think the trouble then is that left me with the project, which was, of course, not in any way done.
Right.
And I'm not even sure it compiled. I think it might have if I started from scratch, but it might not have. But at least, yeah, it got those things out of the way. Now, we're getting to the files that I did actually change. The interface controller file is also a boilerplate class from a WatchKit extension target, but I did make a lot of changes to that, so that's something that I couldn't be finished with as part of this boilerplate step. And then, you know, the Watch app has no code files at all. The shared framework had a lot of custom files, model classes that I created from scratch. So I recreated those from scratch with Swift. Now, when I started to do that, when I started to make those custom files, I was prompted to make a bridging header file, which is what Xcode does now to let you, I believe the bridging header file that they automatically create is for going from Swift back to Objective-C. And there's a lot of weird things about that. The interesting thing here, though, was that I said no to it because I knew I wanted to convert everything to Swift. So I wouldn't need any bridging at all once I was done. And I realized after I'd said no to it, hey, I don't know how to trigger this later. Because this is one of Apple's kind of just works things with Xcode that they keep doing, where because it's so quote-unquote simple and just works, I can't use it now. And I tried fiddling with things, I tried cleaning, I tried doing it. No, it's just gone. There's a flag in there that they don't want to tell us about that you have to find and switch back before you'll get prompted for that again. That's very annoying.
Mm.
So I really wish they would stop trying to baby us, you know? You know, make it a thing, make it a menu item, you know, use up the precious space in your menus to just give one more thing to me so that I can find it. But no. So, you know, again, I didn't really need it, but I realized that I was shit out of luck if I did need it. Now, there were a lot of dependencies here. The shared framework was used by the extension in the app, the shared model files that were used by the iOS targets and the OS 10 target. And so I found after a certain point that it was impossible to do it sort of piecemeal such that everything still worked. I kind of had to bite the bullet and just say, all right, the things are not going to build until I finish everything, which would, you know, was going to be a problem for people who are trying to do larger scale Swift conversions. I would suspect that Apple will eventually add some sort of converter refactoring to Xcode, but they haven't yet.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, moving on. So when I recreated the interface file, the interface controller file, I found myself dragging a lot from the storyboard file into the code file. And you can do this by going into, which mode is this? It is the assistant editor mode, right? Where you see two panes side by side in Xcode. And if you make it such that one of those is your source code file and one of those is your storyboard file, then it's very easy to drag from out, control drag from one of the elements of your storyboard into your code file. And that gives you a fairly automated way for Xcode to offer to create things like outlets and actions for you. And I don't really do that very much in Objective-C because it's almost faster for me to just type it than to set up those editors in the way that you need to set them up. But I did that here for Swift because I knew that Apple would then create these outlets for me in the exact way that they wanted it to be. So that would give me the correct way to do it, the correct format, all of the right code words, because the keywords to do this are different in Swift and in Objective-C. So if you don't want to, you know, spend a lot of time looking those up, you got to do it that way. I think they are weak. There's a bang at the end. There's an exclamation point at the end. I'm not quite sure what that... Does that mean that it's optional? Or does that mean... I thought question mark meant that it was optional. Maybe it means it's a forced, unforced optional? Forced optional. Something like that. And, you know, I wouldn't have known that just from my little playing around with it otherwise. So, and then they use, instead of just IB outlet, they use at IB outlet. And they make it weak and all this other stuff. So you'll find that out for yourself if you try this, or if you do what I didn't do, which is go look at the documentation to find out how to do it. But, you know, this was faster. So I had a bunch of classes involved, and since I'm kind of running out of time, I won't go through too much of them. But I did find that of the three model classes that I was using to represent the game logic, and these were pretty much to create the game logic, to do the calculations to figure out what the game contents would be versus loading in the game contents for use at runtime versus just the class that would contain that data. Only the one that contained the data was one that needed to be turned into a struct or a value class in Swift. Now, as you know, there are reference classes and value classes in Swift. There's a difference between classes and structs. And structs the value classes are meant to be just copied around by full-scale copying them. You're not really meant to have one copy that you pass around a reference to. You're meant to just copy it around and use it as is. And in my case, the creator and the reloading logic was something that it didn't make sense to make into a value class. But there was a turn class that had all of the shapes that were to be shown to the user for a particular turn. And I'm not going through the details of what the program did. You want to go to last week's episode, Pyramid of Doom Death, where I talk about what the game was. But in this case, it's just holding that data. And actually, there were helper methods on it to sort of bring in that data from a plist dictionary and turn it back into a plist dictionary. But those were just helper methods. They weren't the actual data. So I found that it was useful there to use struct. I did find that I was using the... What was it? Do I have a list here? There are plist foundation level helper methods to get just write out a plist and read in a plist. And they use NS Dictionary because they are regular Cocoa classes. And so it was actually interesting that I had to go back and forth between, therefore, NS Dictionary representations of things and my Swift native classes, native objects versus things. And it turns out that that's pretty easy, that you can just say... So I had like a dictionary, and I wanted one of its values to come back as an array of ints, an int in this case being a Swift data type. And of course, for Swift arrays, they are typed arrays as opposed to NS array, which is untyped complete list of anything. And all you have to do to turn from what would be an NS array to a Swift array of ints is just say, you know, blah, 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 as int, or as int with the brackets around it. And it will try to convert that for you. And you know, and that seemed to work for me.
Which is interesting. Because that easier. Yeah, it's interesting because that could be fairly expensive. But it's like a very easy language statement.
Easy language, yeah. Let's see. And then I'm just going to go over some miscellaneous stuff. I used arc4random_uniform.
Right.
Which appears to be the most recent thing for using random generation, the most kind of up-to-date and you know, least gotcha oriented thing for that. But that takes a uint32. And because of Swift's type fussiness, I found that I had to I had to cast my int that I passed into it into a uint32, and then I had to convert the value coming out of it, which is also uint32, back to an int. There's just a lot of casting that goes on if you want to use any other APIs. You can call the API directly. It's a C API, but you can just call it. But you do have to do a lot of casting to get things through. And that casting is the C++ form of casting instead of the C form of casting.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's interesting, because C, you just put the type in the parens before the thing you're trying to cast. In Objective-C, the parens are around the thing you're trying to cast, and then the type is in front of it. And that seems to be because they treat it as if it's a constructor. So you're basically constructing a new thing based on that type, because constructors are not just for classes, or at least even if it are just for classes, virtually everything in Objective-C is actually a class instead of necessarily a... No, because ints are number. Ints are a library type.
Yeah.
It does... Anyway, so... That was kind of interesting to me. Another thing was I needed in a few places to go through the usual sort of for loop where it's, you know, 0, 0 up to but not including count, right? And in C, it's pretty easy, you know, 4 = i = 0, I is less than count. Well, I guess it's not that easy, but i++. And in Swift, there is this idea of saying for I in 0... count. And that's certainly much faster, it's much simpler, but it's also wrong. Because the ... is an inclusive operator. It goes from 0 including count. So you need to use ... less than to simulate what you would do in your C loops, which works. I don't find it very elegant. And it's also something that you would probably never guess, right? You just assume, hey, dot, dot, dot seems to be what I need.
Yeah.
So that was a little unusual. And then a couple more things. When I had an optional, an array that, excuse me, a method that returned an optional, like I used NS bundle, right?
Sure.
To get the main bundle, and you say URL for resource with extension. And that's an optional, because you might not get back a URL for that.
Yeah.
And I found in a lot of cases where in Objective-C, I would just assume that it was not nil. Here, you can't assume that, right? Because optionals are treated differently. So there are a couple of cases where I said, well, I don't want to deal with error handling in this very, very simple case, which is, you know, it for my OS X command line utility, it's not meant for users to run. It's meant for me to run. So right. I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time writing error code into it. I found, you know, you can just put the exclamation point at the end and, you know, bam, it's the type then, like, you know, so I said, let URL, where URL is a local variable, equal this thing. I converted that URL from an optional to a regular representation by putting that bang at the end of the line. Mm-hmm. And that just said, well, hey, if it ever is nil, you're going to blow up.
Yeah.
But since it isn't, or if I can pretty much assume that it isn't going to be, then I can go ahead and use the URL without having to worry about its optionality later on. And I don't like the idea that it's so easy to get into that habit of it.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be very hard to actually, in the whole sort of Cocoa slide thing that I like to do, where I like to just, you know, scan down things, I don't like the exclamation point anyway as a way to say not something, because it's very easy to miss. I think it might be easy to miss here as well. But I think optionals is a whole other topic, so we'll leave that to later. I also lost a little time. I think I tweeted about it, about the fact that plus equals for an array won't add an individual element to an array anymore, even though Apple's first version of its Swift book said it would. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that they would only want to use plus equals or any of the other overridden operators for one thing rather than for everything. But it was still, it shows how arbitrary that is. And one reason why, again, I just don't like using operators, overloaded operators very much. Because if there are three different things you could use plus for, you've got to arbitrarily pick one. And the rest of them are going to be out of luck. So, yeah. And then the last thing, you know, I don't worry about that. So that would be pretty much it for me. Wolf, your thoughts?
I will say that it's weird how, you know, I don't know how long we've known each other, like maybe a decade now, probably a little bit, I guess more than that.
Because of MacCat, yeah.
But it's very interesting because I've been, you know, pretty isolated as a programmer, and you obviously have worked amongst the other programmers at Apple and other corporations, and yet we come upon the same type of stuff. Like, I think your call, making a project from scratch type stuff, you mentioned yourself how that was the fastest way to kind of page stuff in. It's this type of this technique is fantastic for kind of forcing you to learn all the little leaf nodes there, because nothing's going to work until you actually get it all copied over. And so it's very tempting when you have a project that's like almost working, or like, oh, I'm going to convert this to Swift, to try to do it all in place. But this, starting with that clean sheet and having to copy everything over and having to look at everything, it's this really opens your eyes to all the little thorns there. So I'm a big fan of that technique, and that's one of the reasons why, like, when it's harder now that Apple's shipping OS updates yearly, but I do prefer actually starting with a brand new version of Mac OS and copying over the things that I need. And that way, it's kind of a timer for reflection. You know, some people have New Year's resolutions. I migrate my system. Like, do I really need this app anymore?
Well, and this is the core data stuff that you do, which I'm currently blanking on, which lets you take the boilerplate files that Apple provides and then put your own logic in a separate file instead of the actual file. It would be nice if you could do that with Apple's templates as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because they changed the OS templates.
They do.
The project templates for, you know, OS X apps or iOS apps, they've changed those quite a bit. So if you're a three-year-old project, there are things you won't even know about because Apple doesn't necessarily make a big deal out of the improvements that they've made in their templates that you only find out about if you make a new project.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Everyone should do that. If you have an app that's been shipping for a number of years, create a new project for it and just, you know, look at the things that have been added for you. And yeah, it's a new world.
Okay. Is that it?
That's it.
That's it. All right. We'll see you next time.